Thank you all for coming, and indeed, it's a great honor, perhaps not richly deserved, of the Sergey Wilde lectureship. Rather than go over some things about my career, I thought what I would spend my time, and especially your time today, is talk about things that have fascinated me over the years. And with Forest Soils, there's nothing so fascinating as stories of the O-Horizon. So many people who visit a place like Bryce Canyon National Park may ooh and ah at the deep red soils that are obvious there. But for me, it's that very top little layer that beneath the green trees and the green vegetation that really deserves our best science and interest. Rather than start the first words of my own or Dan Richter's, I thought we'd let Sergey speak a little bit for himself. The geologic substratum, that red stuff in my previous picture, is dead. It's sterile. It cannot be the parent material to anything, least of all to the animated entity we call soil. When pedologists brushed off that dead litter on top of the soil, they removed with it not only the practical interests of silviculture, because the forest soil O-Horizon is so important, but also the scientific foundation of soil genesis. If you want to generate a forest soil, that O-Horizon in most places of the world will be the focal point of what's really going on. The surface layer of forest soil represents a dynamic entity in which the energy of dead remains is transferred to new organisms and new compounds. That's where our soils come from. So that's what we'll be talking about today. The unique horizon of forest soils. The reason we have forest soils as a domain is because, well, let's see, we have soil chemistry, but so do other domains. We have soil biology, well, they've got that. We've got soil physics, well, they've got that. We've got an O-horizon, and most of the other soils around the world don't have O-horizons. So that's part of the reason why forest soils needs to be a uniquely respected domain of its own. Sure, we'll integrate with those other fields, but the O-horizon is really our claim to fame. Now, you often hear that beauty is only skin deep. Well, the O-horizon is the skin of the soil. And there's some good physiology that goes down in this deep pit in Brazil from Jean-Paul Leclau. But I'm not going to talk about all that, even though Richter and others love that deep soil stuff. I'm going to stay right up there at the top. But first, we have to think about communication about these O-horizons. Words have great power, but not always the power we have in mind. So here's an example. What are fossil fuels? If you ask an American, where did fossil fuels come from, you know what 47% of them will say? Dinosaur bodies. That's not where they come from. And so experts who want to educate us about fossil fuels no longer use the word fossil fuels. They say coal, oil, and gas. Coal, oil, and gas. Coal, oil, and gas. It rolls right off their tongues because that lets people know they're not talking about dinosaur bodies. It tells them exactly what they're talking about. Okay, to make my point, piece number two, if you asked to consider the mass of these two animals, an adult one on the left, a juvenile on the right, you might wonder which one has more mass. Well, there's something missing on the one on the right, and it's a thing that makes it totally unique. It's missing its trunk. But the hippopotamus doesn't have a trunk, so let's take the trunk off the elephant before we start comparing them. That is what soil scientists do when they come to our soils. They think that the forest floor is something they have to lift up so they can get to the real soil underneath. And if you listen to the conversations, even among ourselves in this group, we often talk about the forest floor and then the soil, or the carbon leaving the forest floor and entering the soil, as though that forest floor was not already soil itself. So this is an O-horizon. It's not a forest floor, by golly. It's an O-horizon. It's where the soil starts. It's an integral part of the soils, and it's why forest soils are a domain unto themselves. It's not just a semantic point. A few years ago, some authors tried to review the literature about how do soils change when we put trees on old agricultural soils. A great question, a great topic, and 90% of the papers didn't bother with that O-horizon because the ag soil didn't have an O-horizon, so it's not fair to include it when the trees come along. One of the stupidest things you'll ever hear, and yet more than 90% of our very bright colleagues in ecology and soil science have made that mistake. That's why we want to emphasize the ode to the O-horizon. The O-horizon, it's got all kinds of obvious things. I'm not going to go into great detail, but I thought I needed to mention them in passing. They moderate the temperatures that are experienced in the mineral soil. the environment of the O-horizon, as we heard yesterday, is not the same microenvironment as in the mineral soil. We have greater swings in temperature in the top of the O-horizon, but then, having the O-horizon there, we moderate the swings in temperature in the mineral soil below that. It makes all the difference in the world biologically if that soil, that clay soil, has an O-horizon at the top, or if it just has bare mineral soil at the top. This is old stuff, though, but I don't want us to forget the microenvironmental issues that go along with O-horizons. Of course, they're the sponges that absorb intensive rainfall. So if we have something like a beetle kill phenomenon, as we do across much of the West with many of our lodgepole pine forests experiencing great mortality of big old trees, the O-horizon is retained in this case, whereas the other thing that's happening across the West are fires, and the fires tend to consume our O-horizons. And this makes all the difference in the world hydrologically. If we have the O-horizon, it turns out the hydrograph of a watershed doesn't really change much, because that O-horizon is there to moderate the hydrologic regime very nicely. This isn't the best example of what happens after a fire, but in Colorado, if we look at peak discharges, the biggest floods of the season, or in 2013, we had one of our biggest rainstorms ever. If you drop all that water onto an area that has no O-horizon, you get a flood that's 5 times greater than if you drop that water onto an area with an O-horizon. O-horizons rock. Although that may be mixing up my chemistry a little bit. And when we consume O-horizons in fires, that mineral layer underneath really misses it. This is maybe an extreme example. It's a very loose soil near Pikes Peak. But when they put up this curtain to catch the erosion off this very mild little gully, and a gully that doesn't have a very large contributing area, it filled up right away, and they had to put in a second apron, and then they had to keep digging them out and weighing the mass in order to measure erosion. There was so much coming off when that O-horizon was lost. And after fire, just the professor in me wants to point out that hydrophobicity is something you hear about. It's kind of like a Walt Disney movie, Old Yeller, where they talk about hydrophobia and they fear the hydrophobia of the dog. Hydrophobicity clearly happens, but the real reason we get massive erosion after fires is probably that loss of the O-horizon and its sponge abilities. The hydrophobicity is important, but that's not the big part of the story. It's the O-horizon is the big part of the story. So we have beautiful variations in O-horizons across all kinds of scales of space and time and management. Here's a site. Is Andy Scott here, by the way?
No.
I hadn't run into him yet. Well, then I can say anything I want. This is the place where Andy Scott did his master's thesis down in Texas. And it's a species trial, a common garden that I've enjoyed this approach to so much. And if we take one sample of the O-horizon and look at its mass, and then we move a half meter away, the mass of that sample is going to be probably somewhat similar to the first one we took. But if we go 2 meters away, it might be less similar. And in this example, if we go 8 meters away from where we took the first sample, we have no ability to predict the O-horizon mass over there based on what we know over here. So we can look at the scales of variation, and quantitatively that can be pretty interesting. But in terms of processes, I think this is a lot more interesting. This is a map of how that O-horizon in this one particular white oak plot differs with space. There's a fivefold range in O-horizon mass at 40 years of age. It'd be kind of nice to explain why that happens the way it is. Is it microtopography? Is it something about the location of the individual trees? Is it little wet spots versus not so wet spots? Is it subtle variations in the clay content of the mineral soil? I'm not quite sure what's going on here, but that O-horizon in 40 years is telling us something huge about what's going on in that soil over 40 years under the influence of these white oak. Another point that the professor in me always wants to mention is that we can look at variability and we can examine it in multiple ways. We can look at the coefficient of variation. How big is the standard deviation of the observations in relation to the mean, the average size of the population? And we find that among those samples we might take into single plot, the coefficient of variation is about 50%. It's a lot of variation around that average tendency for biomass in the plot. But based on Andy Scott's thesis, if we had multiple plots of white oak in the same vicinity, the coefficient of variation between the plots was only about 10%. And so we always want to be very careful in our approach to forest soils. Are we wanting to map the variation for its own sake, which is often interesting, or do we want to talk about the central tendency And if we want to talk central tendency, it's often of a big population of inference, like the electorate of the U.S. of A. today, not just what my Aunt Betty might be voting today or another day. The experimental design gives us a wildly different opportunity to detect changes if we have a coefficient of variation of 10% among plots versus 50% within plots. But that's all I get to say here, because I said that at another Soil Science Society of America meeting about 10 years ago. The beauty of the O-horizon is that it varies so much across mountainsides. Here's an example, an old one from Spruce Fir Forest in Colorado. And here we're not looking at the mass of the O-horizon, but what does it mean for the availability of nitrogen for plants? The open bars are the O-horizon, and the slashed bars, hashed bars, are the mineral soil, 0 to 15 centimeters, I think, in this case. And you can see as we get to richer sites or poorer sites in terms of nitrogen supply across these mountainsides, it's the O-horizon that really differs between plots. There's some difference in the mineral soil, but the O-horizon is what's driving the major part of our story here. But if you look at some aspen forests, it's not quite so clear and so simple, even though they're in the same region. We might start looking at some categories like those porous four, the least lowest supply of nitrogen among this set of 10 sites. And they kind of have a constant proportion. The O-horizon is really important, more important than the mineral soil. Then we might have another set where they all have equal availability of nitrogen, but the proportion contributed by the O-horizon is different than the in one site versus the next site. Or in this last group, the mineral soil was providing exactly the same amount of nitrogen for the trees and plants to use, but the O-horizon gave a real boost to that best of all sites. This is the stuff of which exciting science can be built. Looking back in North Carolina, loblolly pine was kind of something that was hard not to work on. It was sort of an important topic there for all kinds of reasons. And something that amazed me then, and I have no explanation for now, is the O-horizon is not the same from one loblolly pine stand to the next. Above ground, the way that Rob Harrison was showing us yesterday, above ground, loblolly pine plantations, one looks very much like another. But when it comes to the mass of the O-horizon, it's easy to get a five-fold range in how much has accumulated there. One site, the one that has 55 tons, megagrams of O-horizon per hectare, that's more than half of all the litter that had fallen in the 25 years that forest had been growing. It was still there. Somebody ought to go explain that for me before I retire, okay? I'd like to know why. Well, if we look at other parts of the world, these questions of why do the O-horizon stories differ have been addressed by some very careful science. Here's a favorite example of mine from Scandinavia where you take 1,000 soil samples and you do them on very dry locations, wet locations, up and down geographic gradients, warm sites in the south, cold sites in the north, and then you can fit beautiful response surfaces. And now we know that O-horizons across Scandinavia have greater mass when the temperatures are warmer or when there's greater annual precipitation. This doesn't include boggy sites or wetland sites or peatland sites. These are all what we'd call well-drained upland sites. The soil carbon goes up when temperature goes up. Aren't we supposed to think that soil carbon goes down when the global warming kicks in over the next century? Doesn't everyone think that we're going to have an increase in decomposition and that's why we're going to have less carbon in the soils as time goes by? Well, this geographic gradient, as well as gradients of empirical observations from boreal forest to tropical forest, all support the idea you get more carbon as you go south. Not always in just the O-horizon, but more total soil carbon. When it gets warmer, you get more carbon in the soil. So we can do all those soil warming experiments we want, but if we look at geography over periods of decades and centuries, soil carbon seems to go up when temperatures go up. But decomposition goes up when temperature goes up. Well, you know, maybe the storage of carbon is not about decomposition rates. Maybe it's about stabilization rates, which was an idea that Helga van Meegeroot emphasized for us yesterday, and it really is reflected well here. Decomposition and accumulation of carbon are not quite, but almost, totally unrelated. All right. One of my first exposures to O-horizons came with Wally Covington when he was a new young professor out in Arizona, and this had been his PhD study at Hubbard Brook, and he did a chronosequence because he wasn't going to stick around for 200 years working on his thesis. He was going to do a chronosequence to answer a 200-year question, and he found that after clear cutting, forest floor, or as he called it, O-horizon as I would call it, dropped for quite a while, and then it came back again. The statistics are pretty good on that. That you can fit that curve with a very high level of confidence. Interestingly, he didn't use the word soil in his paper, except when he used the phrase soil temperature. For him, the O horizon was not there. It wasn't part of the soil. He was only working on forest floor. He wasn't working on the soil. Again, those semantics really kind of color how we think about our subject. Well, that beautiful pattern that Wally came up with, Ruth Yanai and Tony Federer and others have gone back and tried to see if we should have confidence in that story. And it's an interesting tale in its own right. But basically, they're concluding maybe that beautiful tale doesn't really hold up very well. I asked Wally about it 2 weeks ago, and he said he's pretty confident his pattern was right and that they didn't do their sampling as well as they thought they did. Which makes me want to go out there and sample it myself so that I'll have confidence in the answer. Anyway, O horizons change over time as well as space and environmental gradients. We can try our chronosequence studies, but if we're really lucky, like Dan Richter is, we can inherit a site where some great soil scientists and foresters of the past created opportunities for us to measure things in one location over long periods of time. So this is the famous Calhoun site, freshly planted. And 50 years later, where do we find the carbon that's accumulated in this ecosystem? You may know Dan's story, but I want to emphasize one or two things. The biggest part of the carbon that's accumulated, of course, is that above-ground part, the trees, that looks like every other loblolly pine plantation on the planet. A little bit boring. The O horizon, though, accumulated a tremendous amount of carbon, not quite as much as in the trees, but if you compare the size of those two wedges of the pie, that O horizon is a pretty darn big wedge. And those mineral soils, which is what everybody else in the meetings here get to talk about, well, that didn't accumulate any carbon worth mentioning at all. So all the action in the soil at Calhoun, in terms of accumulating carbon, was an O horizon story. Isn't that something? Well, now we can go into greater time, deeper time, and for that we probably are stuck using chronosequences because no one was measuring soil carbon thousands of years ago. So this is a favorite example of mine from some lakes in Scandinavia where you can go measure the O horizon on a little island like that. And now on a little island like that, the O horizon accumulates over time. There's decomposition, there's stabilization, and occasionally there's fire. But if it's a big island, lightning is more likely to start a fire than if it's a small island. Just statistically, big islands get hit more often than little islands. So a big island in the top there is burning, whereas a little island on the left in the bottom picture is not burning. But by golly, that little island on the bottom right, it burned. And so looking at islands of different sizes can give these Swedish and other scientists an opportunity to look back in time because the big islands have younger O horizons, the little islands have old O horizons. So this is David Wardle and a variety of students. So on a large island where the fires come back more frequently, this area last burned 205 years ago. The O horizon is 15 centimeters deep, which is a pretty respectable O horizon with about 120 megagrams per hectare of biomass. A medium-sized island that doesn't burn nearly so often, last burned almost 2,000 years ago, and it's accumulated twice the O horizon that the larger island with the thinner O horizon is accumulated. But then if we go to a place that hasn't burned for 3,000 years, the O horizon has gotten even deeper. What a fascinating opportunity to look at long-term soil development. And if you look at the mineral soils across these islands, boring. The story of soils and of forests and the vegetation and the fungi and the bacteria, everything that goes on in these islands relates to that O horizon that's accumulated to different amounts over time and the chemistry that goes along with time and the biology that goes along with time. And without fire in this case, the decomposition just never keeps up with the stabilization. All right. So if decomposition is so rapid, as it is in many places, how is it we have any soil carbon accumulating the O horizon anyway? Shouldn't our O horizons be pretty ephemeral and disappear very quickly and maybe equal only 2 or 3 years of litterfall? Well, this is one of the hardest things I have to explain to students, that O horizons and soil carbon in general is often pretty darn old, but decomposition, which is not really related to accumulation of carbon, is often very fast. How is that possible? So here's an example I'd welcome you to develop on your own and show to students if you'd like. In a spreadsheet, I came up with a rate of litterfall or root input, whatever you want to call it, of 3 megagrams per hectare per year. Not that much, but a reasonable amount. And every year, 10% of whatever falls decomposes, and it keeps that 10% decomposition rate forever. here's what the spreadsheet does over a 500-year period. If we don't have any sequestration of the carbon or recalcitrance or whatever we'd want to call carbon, putting it into a pool that will not decompose, it turns out that our average horizon mass is going to be 30 tons per hectare. And that stuff's going to be pretty darn young. It's going to be only 15 years old. But now let's take 1% of that annual input of carbon, and we're going to sequester it somehow. We're going to stabilize it. It's recalcitrant. I'm not quite sure what the best word is, but we're going to put it somewhere that decomposition doesn't get it. We're going to stabilize it. Well, if that happens, just 1% of this 3,000 kilos per hectare of inputs, just 1% of it now gives us an O-horizon mass of 43 tons per hectare, which is not that much bigger than 30, right? But the average age now is 345 years. And so the chemistry of that O-horizon that's accumulated is going to be wildly different from the chemistry we'd find in something where decomposition is the only story in town. So these O-horizons, they're not about decomposition, although decomposition's relevant. It's all about what stabilizes. It's all about the carbon that isn't decomposable or isn't decomposed, or the newly synthesized carbon. It's not about decomposition, as Helga stressed yesterday, in line with what Helga stressed yesterday. And those of us who sat through Newt's talk yesterday had a great introduction to the DIRT study, detritus input and removal tests or treatments. And so this is a chance where we can experimentally ask the O-horizon, what is it that makes you tick the way you do? Let's start adding twice the amount of litter, or not letting any above-ground litter come in at all, or let's cut out the roots and not let the roots grow into a plot and see what happens. How important are the roots for the O-horizon? Well, here's the examples from one of their sites at Harvard Forest, and again, this is taken from one of the tables that Newt showed us yesterday. If you have a normal amount of input above ground and normal amount of input below ground, you're going to have an O-horizon mass or carbon content. We've got both of them up here. That's pretty respectable. But now if you double the amount of above ground inputs, all those nice, beautiful deciduous leaves falling down like we rarely see in Colorado, it turns out that even if you double it over a period of a couple decades, not a lot of change happens. The O-horizon gets a little bit more massive, has a little more carbon in it. It's not that exciting of a story, though. It's a great one to have experimented on, but the outcome doesn't really sound all that fascinating. But what happens if you let all that above-ground litter come in as it will, but don't let any roots come in? The O-horizon almost disappeared. So there's something about the roots and the O-horizon that are very intimately connected, and the roots seem to be one of the big reasons why O-horizons accumulate at Harvard Forest. Now, exactly how that works, we can't really tell you. That's going to take some experimentation from some bright people. But isn't that a fascinating, beautiful result? That's the kind of result I'd love to have from a long-term study that I might design. Maybe not totally expected, but totally fascinating when we're done. And, of course, at a single site, rather than look over time or how manipulations of input rates matter, we can look at what happens when we have different species. Does anybody recognize the hand on the right? I just thought I had to ask. That's Vic Timmer. This is a picture from Ontario. It's a common garden where these species were planted on a cornfield 28 years before the photo. And you can clearly see the pine has a very well-respected O-horizon accumulating, and the poor little oak has very little in the way of an O-horizon. But the A-horizon underneath also looks kind of different. So clearly the species of trees that grow on a site matter. But maybe not directly. Maybe it's because they represent different food qualities for the processing of all the biology that goes on in the soil beneath them. So we can do a common garden like this one in Siberia, where we plant the same soil with species that are different above ground, and we can look and see what happens to things like the O-horizon. Here's the soil carbon that's in the topmost part of the mineral soil and the O-horizon. And it turns out there's a lot of difference there. Birch is different than aspen. And aspen is more like Scots pine than it is like birch, and spruce doesn't really look like pine at all. So again, a point that Helga made yesterday is trying to generalize by conifers versus hardwoods. There might be some things you could generalize, but it's not going to be a powerful generalization, even if it's a statistically significant one. But we might want to ask, why do those O-horizons accumulate to different rates, to different amounts under these different species? Well, there are lots of things we can measure that are relevant to that question, but I'm not really sure how they add up to answering or not answering it for us. And the answers we find might not be the same at age 10 as they are at age 30. So here we have microarthropod densities on the y-axis. And you can see that after 10 years, there's not a lot of difference. After 30 years, there's more difference. But it's not the same story at age 10 as it is at age 30. So anytime we're asking how do things change over space, or how do they change in relation to species composition, we also always have to remember how do they change with respect to time. Because there are always interactions in forests. That's why I never use Yeni's soil-forming factors. The interactions are always more interesting than the main factors themselves, and the interactions are exactly what Yeni left out of his equation. And I never went to school at Berkeley, and my lineage doesn't trace to Berkeley, and that's why I don't quote Yeni. Almost everybody, 90% of the people you hear who quote Yeni either went to Berkeley or trace back through Berkeley. It's fascinating. Have a look at it next time you hear someone talk about Yeni. So beautiful answers can tell us a typical story that applies for a particular situation, like this very nice carpet of O horizon from northern Michigan. But also when we have our typical answer, we always want to ask about the variations around that typical answer. What drives the mean to be higher or lower than the mean that is most typical for the kind of situation we're dealing with? So we always want to know about variation and the factors that drive variation. So a single common garden can't really address that because it's all on one soil, it's a one set of weather conditions, etc. And so we want to then go into common garden experiments that are replicated across bigger landscapes where we have more variety of factors influencing development. So here's a case that's just been accepted for publication in my favorite journal, comparing 8 sites in Michigan where pine and hardwoods were right next to each other. And you can see there's not much of an interesting story in the mineral soil. All the way down to 50 centimeters, it's almost the same. But by golly, those O horizons are really different. O horizons are where the excitement happens. Here's a similar study from 9 sites in Austria. And here the mineral soils differ greatly if they're under spruce or under beech for a long period of time. But again, those O horizons are still a big part of the story. And so we don't want to expect that a pattern of hardwood versus conifer from one location, even if well replicated, applies anywhere beyond the population of inference for which that study was designed. We should never look for one answer that's going to fit all the variety of complex interactions of soils and organisms around the planet. All right. I have to say a little bit about taxonomy of O horizons, mostly because I think I have to, even if I don't know what I'm going to say about them. So the idea of Mull and Moore. If you have animals mix in the O horizon with the mineral soil every year, it's sort of a mull. If it sits up there and looks physically distinct, it's a moor. Well, that wasn't good enough for lots of scientists who think there's information lurking in finer and finer characterization of structure of these O horizons. So an example from Canada 30 years ago, the idea of hierarchical organization and classifications is just too seductive for humans, and so Carl Klinke came up with 3 big orders, and then there were 19 groups, like Hemimore and Hemihumimore, which I like saying, 69 subgroups, including an Amphihemihumimore, and a Microvelomotor. Now, if you know you have an Amphihemihumimore, not a Microvelomotor, I don't know what you can then also have the power to interpret. And for me, the value of a classification scheme is always what power of interpretation do you get out of it. And I'm not sure that the taxonomies of O horizons have really had the power behind them that was assumed by the people who came up with them. But this kind of taxonomy is still popular in Europe. There's a big push for all kinds of new categories. And now O horizons might get a different name if they're identical to one another, but they have different kinds of mineral soils beneath them. So a single kind of O horizon could be a terramol, an entomol, or a paramol, depending on what's below it. These might have value that escapes me, but the real question I would have for the people who do this taxonomy is, how do we know there's power in this kind of a classification scheme? And that's all I'm going to say about classification, except to come back to one of my heroes, Carl Olaf Thom. When I was a young graduate student, I had the chance to catch a lecture from him, and he said, it doesn't matter if it's mol or more. If it's in steady state, whatever falls in above is exactly what comes out the bottom. So he really wasn't fascinated by taxonomy as many other people were. And that was a great insight for him to pass on to me as a young student, because I had thought that this forest floor morphology must be really fundamental because everybody was wrapped up in it. But he told me to think more clearly about mass balance, and that was really very useful. All right. And we know, though, that moles turn over faster, right? Decomposition's faster in a mole, and so therefore nutrient supply should be faster in a mole than in a more. It's just axiomatic. But it's also probably just wrong. Here's another of my favorite studies from David Paré up in Canada, where they looked at the more O-horizon and mole O-horizon sites with sugar maple, and they found that there was more phosphorus available to trees when that O-horizon was not intimately mixed with the mineral soil. And that makes sense after the fact, because when you mix organics with mineral, then we have some iron and aluminum in the mineral, and if we're looking for phosphorus, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. Maybe if we can keep the phosphorus in an organic cycle, the trees are going to have better access to it. So even the idea that moles have greater nutrient supply than mores didn't hold up well in this study by Paré and Bernier, and I think it's really a very cool study. All right. But also, we want to make sure in O Horizons we don't ask cause and effect stories and expect cause and effect answers. Almost anything we measure in an O Horizon is going to have circularity to it. So, for example, if we look at earthworm biomass in 14 different sites in Poland, a common garden sort of approach, we find that we have more worm biomass when we have less O Horizon biomass. Well, maybe the worms are consuming the O Horizon, so it's cause and effect. But on the other hand, the pH is higher when we have more worms, so maybe the worms raise pH. Or maybe the species of trees influence soil pH, and that determines which worms are happy, and maybe pH influences what is happening with the O-horizon mass. So all of these cause and effect possibilities make sense, but in an interacting system, cause and effect questions are often not very good questions. That's all I'll say about that. Treatments. We come along and we change soils when things happen to them. And a few things I thought I'd try to share with you that might interest you. The long-term site productivity study, it's the big, one of the bigger legacies that Bob Powers has left us. And it's got dozens of sites, core sites, affiliated sites. And the folks who engage in this long-term site productivity project wanted answers and insights that applied not just to a single boutique site. If I have one site that I love, it's my boutique site, and I might do science on it to understand it. But if I want a powerful answer that'll apply broadly, well, by golly, my experimental design has to go broad, and that's just what the LTSP has done. But you know, I was mentioning that forest floor versus O-horizon. It's just a semantic distinction. It creeps up, though, all the time, even in the writings of some very nice forest soil scientists. So their organic matter 2 treatment, when they remove the slash after the harvest, they also remove the O-horizon, and then they expose the bare soil. The O-horizon is soil, so how can you take it away and then suddenly have the soil exposed? The soil's already exposed. It's the O-horizon. It is the soil. That sounds funny, but it really isn't, because taking off the O-horizon is kind of like shaving in the morning. If I just shave the hairs on my face, I'm taking off the slash. If I shave the face and take off the skin, that's taking off the forest floor. The O-horizon, and that makes all the difference. And it shows up in their data, too. So if you retain the slash, you retain the O-horizon, you have a lot of mineralizable nitrogen. You take off the slash, but you keep the O-horizon, you got a lot of available nitrogen there and the plants are happy. But you take off the O-horizon and you've taken off half of the supply of nitrogen to the trees. The O-horizon is soil, it's the skin of the soil. You take it off and you shouldn't be surprised that there are going to be consequences. If it's just the forest floor, that's just a lot like slash. You can take it off all you want. But if you take off what's really soil, that's when the outcome shouldn't be surprising when you lose availability of something vital like nitrogen. Here's the first study I ever worked on as a poorly paid undergraduate for $2.50 an hour. Whoops. This is Ponderosa Pine, so I'm crediting it down here to the next slide, but this is really a study that Wally Covington did, and he hired me to be the field technician. So I wanted to make sure I was giving you the right example first. Ponderosa pine, you burn it with a light fire, and it turns out the O-horizon mass goes down because the fire burned it off. Well, that wasn't too surprising, but it's what Wally wanted to figure out. How big would that effect be? But then the really surprising thing is Wally had me go back and sample it 6 months later, and there wasn't as much O-horizon as there was right after the fire. There's an additional 4 megagrams per hectare of disappearance of O-horizon material in 6 months. And when it comes to the nitrogen content, It turns out 108 kilograms had disappeared from the O-horizon that was present after the fire, but it wasn't present in the O-horizon 6 months later. That would be a massive slug of available nitrogen to the plants, and exactly what happened there, it's not easy to say. But when I went to North Carolina, it turns out they like to burn their pine forest too, and so I thought I'd repeat this study with a master's student, Peter Schock. And it turns out that the fire there didn't take away very much of the O-horizon because it wasn't a very hot fire. But 6 months later, that O-horizon had lost an additional 7 tons per hectare of mass. Something happened after the fire to cause that O-horizon to accelerate decomposition. Don't know what, but again, that was a 63 kilogram per hectare slug of nitrogen that left the O-horizon and went somewhere, probably to the trees and the other plants, but we don't really know. But these are the kinds of things I like to look for in O-horizons, and they remain mysteries. I'd love to have the rest of you who deal with prescribed fire or intensive fires look for what happens in the months after the fire and try to explain for us what goes on that destabilizes the O-horizon carbon after something like a fire. Well, I think there's some new horizons in O-horizons, and these are more fascinating than anything I've talked about yet. These are the kinds of studies that ask questions that are particularly insightful. They're not questions about how big is the number. They're questions about what's going on inside the O-horizon. So this one comes, again, from Sweden. And here's a typical Swedish soil, a moor horizon. And there's vertical structure in it. You get moss and needles near the top, and then there's a what used to be called by Americans an F layer, a fragmented layer, and then we get into that humified O-horizon layer, and then down into the mineral soil. It turns out what's going on as we go down in depth here is completely different from the top to the bottom. If we these people just happen to look at who's present, what fungal types do we find predominating up there in the top of the O-horizon, and it's pretty much saprophytes, the kinds of fungi that are decomposing to make a living. They decompose big molecules into little molecules, they absorb the little molecules, and that's how they get by. But once we come down into the humus layer, there's not much in the way of those decomposers present. The fungi that dominate down there are the ones that are feeding off the tree, the mycorrhizae. And they're going out there and changing the chemistry of the material, of course, in huge ways. And they're probably decomposing that material to some degree as well, because they have the opportunity to decompose as well as feed off the trees. But as we go down through this profile, it's a wildly different soil community. So you might look at the soil community in Sweden and compare it to South Carolina, and you probably wouldn't find as much difference in spruce forests as you would just by going down in depth from the top part of a spruce soil to the bottom part of a spruce O-horizon. We don't know much about this, though. There are very few studies that have asked these kinds of questions, but I'm hoping that many of you will come up with more in the future. But now we get into something functional that I think is perhaps even a little more fascinating. We all know that mycorrhizae exist to feed trees, right? We like trees. We think the soils are good because they help us grow our trees, but trees are really what it's all about. And the whole reason mycorrhizae exist is to feed the trees. Well, the mycorrhizae may not agree with that perspective that's so common among people. So here's an experiment some other Swedish scientists did where they labeled a soil with nitrogen-15 tracer. And then they looked to see, does the nitrogen-15 tracer show up in the microbial biomass? And it starts out at zero because they hadn't added the tracer yet, and then it goes into microbial biomass and sort of stays there. Did the trees see it? Well, it turns out we started zero for the trees because they didn't have any label before the label was put on. And then over time, the trees saw just a little bit of that labeled nitrogen. But if you do a mass balance, the microbes, those mycorrhizal fungi, kept the nitrogen. They didn't give it to the tree. Unless the soil had been fertilized sometime prior to the N15 addition. If they added unlabeled nitrogen earlier, the mycorrhizae were very happy. They had all the nitrogen they could possibly want. And in that case, they didn't take up very much of the label. Well, they did take up the label. They just didn't hang on to it. So the enrichment of the mycorrhizae was very low in the previously fertilized site. But now they were sending lots of nitrogen into the trees. The labeled nitrogen, not that earlier fertilizer nitrogen. So the labeled nitrogen, it did get into the mycorrhizae, but the mycorrhizae didn't hang on to it. They send it off to the trees. So the whole story being told here is that if it's a poor site, the mycorrhizae are going to go out there and scavenge for nitrogen just like we expect, and they're going to hang on to it. They're not going to give it to the trees. But if there's a fair bit of nitrogen out there, they're going to be good citizens, and they'll pick up that nitrogen and give it to the trees. What a fascinating story of the O-horizon. But we need more studies like that, because, you know, I'm not sure I'm ready to take that conclusion from one study and one location. It was done excellently, but I'm not sure I'm going to take that and run very far with it. So, soils are alive is one of the key things, and here's a quotation that I used in Cincinnati, as a matter of fact, 2 years ago from my Swedish friend Peter Hodberg. Although fragmentation of soil plant system into pieces is sometimes justified, we should recognize that soils are connected to plants as integrally as arteries are to veins in animals, and that our investigations need to embrace these connections rather than sever them in the name of convenience. So we really have to be sure that when we're looking at these soils, we don't just ask how big is the mass, we don't just ask what's the decomposition rate. We want to understand what stabilizes soil carbon. How do these mycorrhizal hyphae connect, and are they saprophytic or mycorrhizal? Just all kinds of processes going on there that really warrant the attention of the brightest minds in this room and any other room. So this is an O-horizon. It is the unique characteristic of forest soils, and we need to celebrate it and get that story out. O-horizons are us. This is, just to remind you, is a forest floor, and this is not what we want the rest of the world to think of when they think of our special, unique forest soils. I should probably let Sergei have the last word here, and I will in just a minute, but I want to stress just a couple of points. One is, he's dead, and you're going to be dead one of these days, and I hope it's not for a long time, but one of these days you're going to be dead. So I want you to spend the time between now and then working on the best possible questions you can come up with. And the best possible questions are going to be really fascinating ones. No matter what answer you come up with, you know it's going to be good because you asked a really good question. And asking how big something is or the taxonomy of something, that may not be so good. But asking what happens if I cut off the litter input above ground or below ground, well, that's fascinating. When you ask exactly, do we have the same fungi top to bottom of an O-horizon or do they shift around, that's fascinating. So I would encourage you in the time you have left to be sure to ask the most fascinating questions you can. The second thing I'd like to stress is that if you ask it only for one place like Sergei's garden there, the answer is only going to apply to his garden. And sometimes boutique science is worthwhile science because what happens in my garden may not just stay in my garden. It may be the same process that happens in everybody else's garden around the world. Or maybe not. So if you're going to have a limited time between now and the time you die and join Sergei wherever he happens to be, you want to have an experimental design that's going to give readers as much power as you can possibly hand off to them, and that's usually not just looking in your own favorite garden. So I titled my presentation today Ode to the O-Horizon because I thought that that might be the most interesting thing I could go on and on and on about. Well, it turns out after I got started on that, I found out that Ode to Forest Soils was once penned by Sergei Wilde. And so I'm going to let him have the last words in my presentation, just like he had almost the first words. And this is only a subset of Sergei's Ode to Forest Soils. I bury me deep in the moldy earth and sprinkle me well with lime, where I can rest in deep, sweet peace until the end point of time. And may the legacy of all your work between now and then stack up reasonably well against the legacy of Wilde's work. Thank you. Quantitative skills were not Dan's strong point. I had to dig him back a little bit. And they don't have to be questions. They can be comments and contrary views, and I bet Dale Cole at least can be relied on if no one else has anything to offer. Dale.
Yeah, Dale does have a question.
Can
I go all the way back to when I was a student as well? Mm-hmm. And have you really made a distinction between happening with conifers and hardwoods, and was appalled by the fact that people would classify all conifers together, hardwoods together. And he wrote an article on this. Mm-hmm. So conifers versus hardwoods, balanced with their divorce.
That is not an article I've seen, so I'm going to look it up. That sounds like one I'd really enjoy.
And I didn't know about it, because
it's an article I was there. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I'll look it up. Thank you.
And there's some more quotes, by the way, by Wilde, that I think are pretty clever. Mm-hmm. I have to start to tap my memory here. Do a study of organic existence is to practice the soul of human existence. Spiritual link class, the last.
If you have more of those to write down, I think you should send them and we'll put them on the webpage for the
Absolutely.
Division.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Lynn. Yes.
And others would be welcome to pen new odes to whatever horizon you like best. We can have odes to deep soil, in fact. If Bill.
Well, by the way, yesterday we were talking, why do you go to tropical systems, do you go to grassland, don't get here, what's going on? And, we discussed it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was considering this topic, I was thinking, why don't grassland soils have well-developed O-horizons? So I asked five different grassland scientists, some very eminent ones, and I got three different answers and two no answers. So maybe in grasslands there's more mixing by animals. Bill was suggesting that it's also maybe more physical breakdown of the material in grassland litter may just be more fragile than the bigger material, rougher material that we have in forests. Or perhaps fires burning through periodically are why tall grass prairies don't have O-horizons. So I'm not totally sure why they don't. I think forests, if we go to the tropics, they have very ephemeral O-horizons just because there's so much animal activity, both big animal and little animal. But I think those are really good questions, and I'd love to see a collaboration between grassland soil scientists and forest soil scientists addressing exactly why we don't have O-horizons in both cases, or why the A-horizons, for that matter, are identical or totally different. I think those kinds of questions are the ones that I really find most interesting. Rob?
We can see chemical reasons for O-horizons or not O-horizons. I think in South Kalimantan, they have sulfur that reduces the breakdown of organic matter. So in a very warm, wet environment, you can build up substantial amounts of
cool
material.
Although Helga would be quick to point out that we don't want to confuse decomposability with stabilization of carbon. So we might have differences in decomposition related to the chemistry, but we might also have different stabilizing processes going on under the influence of sulfur, too. Very cool. Yes?
I feel like I have to move up into Kansas City. And part of in Canada, of course, you have many thick old varieties, which sort of built that classification system. But one of the reasons that I failed to see the actual here about old varieties is the contribution of wooden material. Mm-hmm. And this idea that the old varieties comes from the litter. And in forests, a lot of the old varieties comes from the litter that decomposed and well decomposed wood. You see that H horizon, that H, at least in Canada, has primarily come from the wood and the decomposed wood, and then the litter sits on top of it. It hasn't been generated from litter, foliar litter, accumulating this H horizon and forming this H horizon.
I think that's a really good question of exactly how do these formation activities work on substrates that are quite different. Needles are not the same as twigs, fine roots are not the same as needles, and woody materials are very different as well. And we can use some of the spectrographic approaches that can show us whether the humus material has a little more affinity to wood or a little more affinity to needles, or completely different because it's all microbially synthesized. So I think there's a wild opportunity, so to speak, for people to dive into good questions.
Uh-huh. If you, it makes you look at that, if it only does that, it's valuable. Because it makes you look to see what is the composition. Because that's what the nature of that system is.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to describe what is that old material or elevation material.
Mm-hmm.
them is it mostly comprised of dead bryophytes? Is it mostly composed of dead leaves and twigs, or is it mostly composed of dead wood?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that system was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start looking, you see, at least in Canada, they look at a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
It is mostly wood in many, many cases.
Mm-hmm.
In different stages of
looking for. Nope.
Dan, I concur with your point that words matter. They,
mm-hmm.
they certainly define a lot about how we think about things. Units matter as well. And when we compare organic soils with mineral soils, we need to think carefully about units. And honestly, I'm amazed. I still review papers where turnover is expressed in terms of milligrams per kilogram of soil,
mm-hmm.
in comparing organic and mineral soils. And in fact, one of your slides sort of did that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go back to it, but when we express milligrams of carbon respired or milligrams mm-hmm. of N respired per kilogram of soil, and compare an organic horizon with above density of 0.2 mm-hmm. with a mineral horizon with above density of 1.1, we get a spurious comparison.
And that's,
I review papers every year that make those comparisons.
And the broader issue is, if you don't do mass balance, you lose all the power that mass balance brings to your opportunities. And so that harks back to Carl Olaf Tom, that if you look at mass balance, it's going to give you an anchor point for what you can say and not say that you just don't get looking at concentrations.
Exactly.
That's a great point.
You have to use the appropriate units to do the mass balance.
Yeah. Tom. I did. He used the word forest floor versus soil.
I have to admit, I'm somewhat disappointed in your talk because I was looking for a grand unified theory
mm-hmm.
that was going to explain everything for me. And you didn't provide it. But it's curious to me a lot to look at the difference, as you pointed out, common for hardwoods. In spite of what Doc Wild would say, you've looked in Brazil, right? Why is that the same there? So you look at pine forest floor, right next to a eucalyptus forest floor, and the same phenomenon we see in the southern United States
mm-hmm.
or in the Northeast exists
mm-hmm.
between those two forest floors. The eucalyptus or the hardwood disappear. The overhorizon is decomposed much more rapidly.
Mm-hmm. I've got a long list of questions that I'd like to have answered, and that would be on the list. I don't know why, and I don't even in the Southeast, I don't know why loblolly pine horizons can be 5 times greater in one area than another. I'd love to give you that standard uniform answer that would explain it all, but I don't have a clue. But I've got a lot of bright minds out here, including, it's nice to say, a lot of young minds out here that are going to have careers filled with answering really fascinating questions if they have a chance, so I hope they do. Do you have time for more?
Let's go for two more questions here. Michael.
I am a soil scientist, and I teach a wetland soils group. And I tell you, I can never keep straight definitions of more, mull, and motor. Is there a mnemonic device you guys use? Like a mull okay, while that would...
Perfect. You mull it over, that means you turn it over.
Yeah. What about the rest of them?
And more has more on it. You see more when you walk through the forest.
Right.
Motor is in between. It's not either one of those. But I'm not sure there's a lot of power to those terms anyway. Scott.
Not sure.
What I've seen, good data like Sweden, There's very clear O-horizon patterns where there's more O-horizon when it's warmer. I'm not sure that that would extend to the tropics where I know we have lower O-horizon accumulation than in boreal forests. But if we look at the 0 to 1 meter depth plus O-horizon, that the empirical evidence says always gets higher when it gets warmer as the average tendency around the planet for forests.
So, Ruth, last question.
Well, I think it's healthy for you to insult us,
I hope nobody felt insulted. I really did not intend that. Except maybe Dale, and I didn't really mention him by name, did I?
No, so have you published the boutique site thing yet? Is that something we in the LCR, you know, those of us who are writing
When I came to a soil science meeting that Dan organized a symposium about big questions, and he was talking about long-term studies and the importance of long-term study sites, I said the last thing on earth you want is a long-term study site because it doesn't extrapolate anywhere at all.
Talk about insults. This was an invited speaker.
And what you really want is to spread it around so you have a population of inference that's more than your backyard. I, of course, think the Calhoun site's been incredibly valuable, so it's a little bit of a joking jab to make my point. But I haven't really written it up, except we've got a nice little editorial in Forest Ecology and Management about population of inference, and that's the best place where I've tried to tell this story that one location doesn't give you any statistical power for a population of inference that's outside that one little location. But I never use the word boutique in writing.
I think it's a good catch. You said the language doesn't, and I think it's a good use of language to get us to think about our attention.
Well, thank you. You're welcome to use the boutique word anytime you want to. Anytime you want to insult a colleague's experimental design. Thank you.
So, Dan. Thank you for upholding the quality of this lectureship, and we have a plaque for you. Sergei Alexander Weil, 2014 Distinguished Lectureship on Forest Soils, awarded by the Forest Range and Wildland Soils Division of SSSA to Daniel Binkley.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you bet.
I'm very flattered.